There are some times when we are in such a habit of focusing on the bad news that even when good news happens, we are very reluctant to receive it. Sort of like you suddenly come into a fortune for somebody in your family that you didn't realize was wealthy dies, and you suddenly come in with a fortune. And all you can do is complain about all the years that you had to scrape by on not getting anything. Or even worse, you start complaining about how you wish you hadn't gotten the money earlier. How different your life had been had you gotten it earlier. That you just don't receive the goodness that God has given to you. That you're still stuck back in the unfortunate times and you're very reluctant to move forward even as God blesses you. We are continuing today our study in the book of Genesis. And we are going to see that attitude show up rather abundantly in Jacob. So if you turn to me to Genesis chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46. Genesis chapter 46, starting in verse 1. If you'll remember what we have been following in the story of Jacob and his family, that just in last week's portion, well, this the portion that we studied anyway, we had the brothers reveal, or Joseph reveal himself to the brothers as who he was. And so Joseph went back to his, or Joseph sent the brothers back to his father with wagons full of stuff, all kinds of good stuff, and enough wagons to bring his whole family into Egypt. And so now in this chapter, we have the journey of Jacob, or Israel, from the land of Canaan where he lived into Egypt. So in Genesis chapter 46, so Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. Now there are a couple things going on here. First of all, it's sort of interesting that you get the impression that sacrificing to God was not something that he did all the time. You kind of get the fact that this was mentioned with such great flourish and fanfare that it was not something that he was in the habit of doing, which could have explained some of the things that we've seen in his family and that we're going to see in his own attitude coming up. But at least at this point, we've made mention of the fact in the last couple of sections of that distinction between Jacob and Israel. There we have Jacob, who is now coming to an understanding, coming back to grasping his leadership role, his role not just as the father, but also as the spiritual head of the family. And so now we're still referring to him as Israel, but there's something else that's kind of disconcerting here in this chapter, or in this verse. I get there eventually, where it says that he was offering sacrifices. It doesn't say to his God, but rather to the God of his father Isaac, that a disconnect had occurred here. We will reconnect in a chapter or two, but right now there is that disconnect. Verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. Once again, we have this distinction between these two names. I think Jacob was very fearful. And so God calls him Jacob instead of Israel. Verse 3, he said, I am God, God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. And Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry them. So God promises Jacob, because Jacob had a question here. Here he was. The promised land was behind him, which was not what you would expect. He would expect the promised land to be in front of him instead of behind him. He was leaving the land which God had promised him to go to Egypt, which to him didn't make any sense. And God said, don't worry. I'm going to take you down to Egypt. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to build you into a great nation. And then you're going to come back out again. We've talked about some of the reasons in the last few chapters we've studied why God probably needed to take them into Egypt. The strongest reason being that not only was Jacob and his family in the land of Canaan, but the land of Canaan was in Jacob and his family. That they were taking life. They were handling life the way the pagan peoples around them were handling life. And so God needed to pull them into Egypt, which although it wasn't perfect, it was at least a step or two above the Canaanite religion. Verse 6, they took their livestock and their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him. His sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons, who went to Egypt. Reuben, Jacob's firstborn. Now it's sort of interesting in this list, when you read it, if you would step back and calculate the ages of all those people, no way were all these people alive when he was going to Egypt. So in some sense, God has used this before, in some sense, these people, in God's mind, existed in their fathers who were going into Egypt. So it's like they were going in on behalf of the children, so they were going into Egypt. But yet some of these people were actually born in Egypt and were not there on the wagons. In verse 9, the sons of Reuben, Hanok and Palu and Hezron and Carmi, the sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamim and Ohab and Jachin and Zohar and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. So interesting there too that Shaul was particularly pointed out to be the son of a Canaanite woman. So their family married into the Canaanite families. It was probably not something that they did an awful lot. That Shaul was pointed out as being one of the few. And we also know that Judah's household, that Judah's sons married the same Canaanite woman, or the first two of his sons married a Canaanite woman. Verse 11, sons of Levi, it's going in birth order. Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Judah, Aaron, Onan, and Shelah, and Perez, and Zerah. But Aaron Onan died in the land of Canaan. We heard that story, that was where it was the same wife. The wife started out with being married to Er, and Er died, and then she, because of the Levirate marriage, or the brother taking on the wife of the deceased brother, that Onan took her as his wife, and then Onan died. And then the father was unwilling to give her to Shelah. So instead, she came up with that subterfuge to actually have relations with Judah. So Perez and Zerah were actually sons of Judah, although they were by his daughter-in-law. So your brain starts to hurt when you work out too much. But Perez and Zerah were sons of Judah, not grandchildren. Verse 13, the sons of Issachar, Tola and Puvah and Yob and Shimron. The sons of Zebulun, Sered, and Elon, and Jalil. These are the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Paddan Aram, with his daughter Dinah. All his sons and his daughters numbered 33. The sons of Gad, Ziphion, and Haggai, Shuni, and Ezbon, Eri, and Erodai, and Erali. The sons of Asher, Imnah, and Ishva, and Ishvi, and Beriah, and their sister Sarah. And the sons of Beriah, Haber, and Malchiel. Sarah is one of the few women that are mentioned here. There's no explanation of why. By the way, it doesn't say anywhere else in Scripture why she was mentioned. There might have been other daughters and granddaughters of Jacob, but they were typically not mentioned in Scripture because they were not heads of household. Verse 18, these are the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Leah, and she bore to Jacob these 16 persons. The sons of Jacob's wife Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. Out of Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. The sons of Benjamin, Bela and Becher and Ashbel, Gerah and Naaman, Ehi and Rosh, Mupim and Hupim and Ard. These are the sons of Rachel, who were born to Jacob. There were 14 persons in all. That's where things get a little... people say, well, these might have been people who were actually born in Egypt. That's one of the issues. Benjamin was not that old a man. He has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 children. I mean, you work that out, that's at the very least, that was at least 10 years of somebody bearing children. So unless he started when he was 12 years old, chances are he was, some of these children were actually born in Egypt. Verse 23, the sons of Dan, Hushim, sons of Naphtali, Jaziel and Guni and Jezer and Shilem. These are the sons of Bilhah whom Laban gave to his daughter Rachel, and she bore these to Jacob. There are 7 persons in all. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Egypt who came, house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. Right. Now he sent Judah before him to Joseph, point out the way before him to Goshen. They came into the land of Goshen. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. That's the first time they'd seen each other in 22 years or so. So I'll bet father thought he was dead. That was his favorite son. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive." Well, no, he wasn't let to die right then. He lived for quite a ways longer, that we'll see in a little bit. Verse 31. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household, who are in the land of Canaan, have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have.' Then Pharaoh calls you and says, 'What is your occupation?' You shall say, 'Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians.'" I tried to figure out what was going on here. I'm afraid I ran into the usual rabbinical paradox. Not only that, it's not that you don't find any explanations, you find too many explanations. There seems to be a distinction made here between keepers of livestock and shepherds. But yet, whatever that distinction was is lost in the mists of time. You know, I've seen some theories on some people who talks about the difference in the techniques that livestock was bigger animals, like cows and oxes, and shepherds were the smaller animals like sheep and goats, and some of the issues about pasturing to get them together and all sorts of things. But it is not credible enough to really grasp onto whatever was going on here. Because some people were make a big deal out of this particular fact and this particular distinction in it. We can pretty much assume that the terms used almost synonymously there. Although there does seem to be a distinction that Joseph is making, we don't understand enough to understand the distinction. It's not really important to the story. Whatever it was something that would guarantee that they'd be left alone in Goshen. So one theory is that because Egyptians had such a problem with shepherds that if they're sent in Goshen and they're shepherds, people leave them alone and that they could be really off to themselves. Chapter 47, verse 1. Then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen." He took 5 men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Well, why not 6 or 7 or all 12? Well, it turns out the number 5 was considered a special number to the Egyptians, that they liked the number 5. They, in a lot of their inscriptions and things like that, 5 is considered a very fortuitous number. So that was probably the reason why he didn't take all 12. They just took 5 because 5 was just what you did. It was considered a number to bring. Verse 3, then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" So they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers." They said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land where there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. and if you know any capable man among them, then put them in charge of my livestock. So not only was he settling them, but he was offering them a job, saying, yeah, take care of my livestock too. There are some theories as to why Jacob wasn't the one who really negotiated. That first part was really them negotiating with Pharaoh about their settling. It was that formal decree before this. Pharaoh had told Joseph to do this, but now this is the final legal decree that Pharaoh is saying, this is how it is going to be done. I give you the land, go settle. Verse 7. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh, which is interesting. You would think it would be the other way around, but it's something about just that Jacob is really understanding really a bit of who he was and what God has promised him. So Jacob is the one who blesses Pharaoh. And Pharaoh's first question to Jacob is interesting, considering how old Jacob must have looked. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? His first question to Jacob is, how old are you? Man, how old are you? So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. That's what I was making reference to at the beginning of our study. What a way to answer Pharaoh. Few and unpleasant. Wow. I wouldn't consider 130 to be few and unpleasant. If you wanted few and unpleasant, you look to those two sons of Judah who died, that we just talked about. Was it Er and Onan were the two that God slew? I mean, that was short and unpleasant. 130 years was not short and unpleasant. And here Jacob is going into the very presence of Pharaoh with flocks and herds and all sorts of possessions and 12 strong sons and their children. And all he has to say to Pharaoh is that my days have been few and unpleasant. Jacob, are you there? Wake up, Jacob. What just happened? That he just has not got it yet. We can sort of see some of this in some of the attitudes of Jacob when the brothers came back from Egypt, that he had just somehow lost touch with God and lost touch with the satisfaction and joy that comes from serving God. And so as a result, he's turned into a bitter old man at this point, pretty much. And God's going to work in his life so that when we next see him, he's not going to have this kind of attitude. But wow, what an attitude. Verse 10, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had ordered. Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food, according to their little ones. So they had plenty of food. They had plenty of food. Now there was no food in all the land, because everybody but Joseph and his family, because the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. So it was not just in Egypt, it was in Canaan too. Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food, for why should we die in your presence, for our money is gone? Then Joseph said, give up your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock, since your money is gone. In other words, not feed the livestock, but trade the livestock for the food. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, for the fox and the herds and the donkeys. And he fed them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. When that year was ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent, and the cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left for my lord except our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die. and that the land may not be desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every Egyptian sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. So he had state ownership of everything. Pharaoh owned everything. As for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. In other words, he was consolidating them so it would be easier to take care of. Here he was moving them close to the grain storage cities, because you figure that the people are living all over Egypt and they're coming by foot now, especially because they didn't have any more livestock. Pharaoh owned all their livestock. It would take them maybe a couple weeks to walk the length of Egypt in order to get grain. When they get grain, they'd walk back home, and they have to turn around and come back, because now they need more grain. And there's only so much they could carry. They couldn't carry enough to feed themselves for the amount of time it would take them to travel. So they had to locate them to the cities so that the people could get the grain directly. Verse 22, only the land of the priests he did not buy. For the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. These are not priests of the true God. These are priests of the Egyptian gods. And Joseph said to the people, behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. And at the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food, and for those of your households, and as food for your little ones. This is probably at the end of the famine that he was giving them seed out of the storage facilities and saying, okay, so now here's the deal. You're going to give a fifth to Pharaoh. Now, in truth, Pharaoh owned the lands. They sold them to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh, in truth, could have asked for everything. But instead, he's only asking for a fifth, or 20% of the crop. And apparently, when Egypt was working right, when it was in terms of a time of famine, that they produced so abundantly that one-fifth of their crop wouldn't cause hardship on anybody. They typically produced 30-fold, so enough, each farmer produced enough food, apparently, to feed about 30 people. So taking a fifth of that away, they still had more than enough to feed themselves and to sell. In verse 25, so they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves. Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth. Only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen. They acquired property in it, and were fruitful and became very numerous. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. So he didn't die right away. I mean, here he was, he was saying, I'm going to go to Egypt, I'm going to die, I'm going to see my son and die. Well, he lived for 17 more years after that in the splendor of Egypt. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now my hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me here in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. He said, swear to me. So he swore to him, and Israel bowed at the head of the bed, or bowed on his staff, as some translations say. So at this point, Israel understands God's promise, and he understands that the promised land is behind him, and he doesn't want to be left in the land, in the land of Egypt, because that's not his home. That's not where he's supposed to be. He's supposed to be back in the land of Canaan, because that's what God promised him. So Jacob's getting over his bitterness. He should have trusted God all the time to provide for him. After all, God had always promised that he would be an inheritor of the promise originally given to Abraham. And we ourselves also ought to have trust in God that he will provide for us who are believers in Yeshua. Turn with me to the book of Luke. Book of Luke, chapter 12. Because Joseph took Jacob in the midst of the famine. and he established and he provided for him so that Jacob would have nothing to want. Right? So they acquired flocks and lands and all the rest of it. And we who are believers are oftentimes all consumed with acquiring the things of this world. And Yeshua had something important to say to us in Luke chapter 12, down verse 22. And he said to his disciples, "For this reason I say to you, do not worry about your life as to what you will eat, nor for your body as to what you will put on. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap. They have no storeroom nor barn, and yet God feeds them. How much more valuable you are than the birds. And which of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his lifespan?" Usually worry has the opposite effect, doesn't it? Worry subtracts from our lifespan, doesn't add to it. Does this mean that God is promising us that we will have, you know, 50-inch TVs and the sports cars, or trucks, or whatever it is that, you know, float your boat as far as cars are concerned, and we'll have huge houses and fine carpeting and wonderful furniture? No, because if you would, he compares us to the ravens and the lilies and the, I'm sorry, the ravens, first of all, in this section. And the ravens don't just sit there, and God doesn't rain worms upon them. And the ravens go out and they do what God had set forth for them to do, and God blesses it. They are fed. And so too, God said to us that don't worry about essentials. You should never worry about the wanna-haves, because they're not important anyway. And you shouldn't worry about the gotta-haves, because God provides those. Verse 26, "If then you cannot do even a very little thing, why do you worry about other matters? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, but I tell you, not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass in the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, how much more will he clothe you, you men of little faith?" I guess in our day, you look at the dandelions. Dandelions are very pretty. We mow them down with abandon. Right? But if God so clothes the dandelion, will he not clothe us? "And do not seek what you will eat and what you will drink, and do not keep worrying. For all these things the nations of the world eagerly seek, but your Father knows that you need these things. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to charity. Make yourselves money belts which do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Jacob lost the vision for a while, and that's why he got to be a bit bitter old man. He's looking on the circumstances all around him. He stopped trusting God. Although even at the end of his life, he had a sense that God wanted him to be in the promised land. We as believers in Yeshua, and I guess Jacob also, are, as the book of Hebrews says, looking for a city not of this world. Because we are looking for a city not of this world, that we should not be distracted and dismayed by the things that happen to us in this world, but rather that we are to trust God to provide the essentials and not try to build up our treasure here. Because in verse 35 of Luke chapter 12, "Be dressed in readiness and keep your lamps lit. Be like men who are waiting for their master when he returns from the wedding feast, so that they may immediately open the door to him when he comes and knocks. Blessed are those slaves whom the master will find on the alert when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will gird himself to serve and have them recline at the table and will come up and wait on them. Whether he comes in the second watch or even in the third and finds them so, blessed are those slaves. Be sure of this, that the head of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have allowed his house to be broken into. You too be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect." Sort of like a child, you know, we're sort of like children who are playing the board game, or, you know, nowadays a computer game, and it gets to be dinner time, and the parents call, it's time to put that down and move on. Because even though you might have learned some things from that game, and that game might have been fun, still it's time to move on. And if you played that game instead of doing what the parent wanted, then it doesn't matter what kind of score you got in the game, you're in trouble. So too in this world, that we can be about the game of this world, the uselessness, the useless pursuits that all the people around us seem to be involved in, and get so involved in that, that when our master calls us to him, which can happen at any time, either by his returning to us or our returning to him through death, that when that happens, then we better have been about his business, because he's not going to ask for your business card. He's not going to look at your bank statement. He's not going to sit down and ask to watch TV with you and say, "Ooh, look at that. That's a cool TV. I'm glad you bought that." But instead, he's going to look at how faithful you were at serving him and serving others. And how much did you have that attitude towards building treasure in heaven rather than building treasure on this earth? There's nothing wrong with riches in this world. Jacob was very rich, and he came back to God. There are other people in Scripture who are very prosperous and very well known, very well renowned for their faith in God. But there is a big problem for putting your trust and putting your faith and putting your love in that treasure that's on this earth. Loving it and desiring to pursue it more than you desire to pursue God. And that, in the end, will only lead to the bitterness that Jacob experienced, and also in the end of his life, other people like Solomon experienced. That you get to the end of your life, and you find out that you wasted your life on the wrong thing. What was it somebody said? That many people waste their time climbing the corporate ladder only to find out it was leaning against the wrong building. That it just wasn't. You climb the ladder and you get over the top and you figure, wow, this is the wrong place. I'm in the wrong spot. I wasted all that time and here I am. But rather, the antidote to the kind of bitterness that Jacob had is to trust God and serve him. And we ought to have that kind of joy and satisfaction in our lives. Too many times believers are just as negative as Jacob, or people who claim to be believers, let's say that, are just as dour as Jacob was. And how attractive is that to the people around us? We have to really watch that in our day, because it can be a very depressing kind of environment. On the job, oftentimes, standing around the water cooler, used to be water cooler, I guess now, the coffee machine and the microwave. It's not so much how wonderful my job is and all the great stuff that I'm doing and all the great things we can do here at our company, and isn't it wonderful that they pay us so much? But too many times around that gathering of employees, it's more like, oh, you know, the boss is an idiot and I don't get paid enough and this job's really boring and I hate it and all the rest of it. And that doesn't exhibit the kind of satisfaction we are forgetting. We're being just like Jacob. We're ignoring all the good things God is doing for us instead of focusing on the challenges of our life. And so it makes us very bitter. It makes us very, very bitter. Let's close. Dearest God and Father, protect us from bitterness and worry and fear. Remind us always that you are more than capable of supplying what we need, and that we don't need to worry or be afraid, that we don't need to focus on accumulating treasure in this world, but rather we need to give you all that we have, all that we are, and focus on building treasures in heaven, that we might glorify not ourselves, but glorify our Messiah and our coming King, Yeshua. Amen.